Hello and welcome once again, podcasters, to this series of podcasts brought to you by Kilkenny Library Services in partnership with Kilkenny County Council and the Decade of Centenaries Fund. My name is Owen Swinton Welsh, and in these podcasts we focus on revolutionary era Kilkenny. Today I will take a look at the Coolbawn ambush, which occurred in the final weeks of the War of Independence on Saturday the 18th of June 1921. Coolbawn is a townland just 4 kilometres north of the town of Castlecomer on the main road to Attoy. Today it's part of the N78 National Road. Indeed, a lot of people will have used that road to get to Dublin for the matches back in the day before the new motorways were built. What I will attempt to do today is to look at the Coolbawn ambush through the lens of what happened, of course, but also what was supposed to have happened, who was involved, along with the repercussions of the event. We will take a look at some of the key protagonists, especially the two Flying Column members who lost their lives that day, namely Nicholas Mullins of Thomastown and Sean or Jack Hartley of Glenmore. Now, in a nutshell, the plan was for an IRA flying column with the help of the local 3rd IRA Castlecomer Battalion to ambush a convoy of 2 lorries of Crown Forces which transported the explosive material gelignite from Castlecomer Military Barracks to the Wolf Hill coal mines, which were about 13 kilometres away just over the Leash border. Gelignite was of course needed for the coal mining process. The Castlecomer Colliery Company was established by the famous Wandersford family, who were the major landlords in the area. Castlecomer Collieries was one of only 2 private companies licensed to have gelignite in the whole of Ireland during the period we're talking about here. By the way, getting a target at this juncture of the War of Independence was quite tricky for the IRA. At this stage of the conflict, right around the country, the Crown Forces didn't keep to a routine or schedule as they may have done, say, in the early stages of the conflict. This made planning an ambush rather difficult. However, at least in Castlecomer, it was widely known that the Crown Forces had to take the same route to the collieries 2 or 3 times a week, usually in the morning. Hence, ambushing them was a very appealing target for the IRA. Indeed, the IRA had planned to ambush this convoy on at least 2 occasions during the months previously, but the ambush never came off for one reason or another. The Crown Forces themselves had also beefed up their security. Travelling in a convoy of at least 2 lorries with upwards of 30 men with all the arms they had at their disposal was quite an intimidating foe. Now, I should probably state from the start that the aftermath of the Coolbawn ambush was one of the most controversial events of the War of Independence in County Kilkenny, and that's simply because of the fact that it didn't go according to plan. When something like that happens, of course there is going to be recriminations and finger-pointing. Events that don't go according to plan can still stir up passions just as much as events that do go according to plan, even after 100 years removed. But I will attempt to find closest to what happened in Coolbawn with the information and evidence to hand. This includes testimonies of a range of people who took part or who were close to people that took part. The newspaper articles of the time are very useful, the medical reports of the victims, the IRA pension files and witness statements, and the Crown Forces report of the incident, which was quite detailed. All these sources will of course have their own biases, it's only natural, but while being conscious of the different perspectives, a clear picture can emerge by blending these stories together to get the most accurate picture of what occurred. Now to get into our story, who are our leading characters? The main ambush party at Coolbawn were known as the No. 1 Kilkenny Active Service Unit, also known as an ASU or a Flying Column. Sometimes they were referred to as the East Kilkenny Flying Column, the latter to differentiate them from the column in West Kilkenny based around Callan. They were technically under the overall command of George O'Dwyer. Indeed, at this stage of the War of Independence, George O'Dwyer was the Kilkenny Brigade OC, or Officer Commanding. That meant he was the overall commander of the entire County Kilkenny IRA. The day-to-day management of the column was left to Michael O'Carroll and John Welsh of Greignamana, and we'll talk a little about them and how the column came into existence later. But first, take a look at George O'Dwyer. Who was he? He's quite an interesting man, actually, I think. He was born in Cruttonclough, Coon, in Muckalee Parish on the 19th of September 1885. This is actually only about 6 kilometres from Coolbawn and even shorter through the fields. He would therefore have known the lay of the land fairly well around Coolbawn. Hence, he would have been 36 years old at the time of the Coolbawn ambush, likely one of the oldest present. His parents were James and Catherine Dwyer, Ní Poole, who were both from farming stock. George had a lot of life experience experience in comparison to other young men from rural Kilkenny. He joined the DMP, that's the Dublin Metropolitan Police Force, in 1908, but he then emigrated to Australia and joined the police force in Sydney. Perhaps he thought he'd never see the shores of Ireland again, as was often the case for immigrants at this time. However, in 1914, his 21-year-old brother James unexpectedly died, having caught TB. Sadly, it was the same disease, tuberculosis, that claimed the life of George's father in 1900, when George was only 14. George was subsequently summoned back to Ireland by his mother to look after the farm. So George returned to Ireland around 1918 after the war. He was quickly elected captain of his local Coon Irish Volunteer Company. No doubt his experience in the forces was a great boon for them. This volunteer company had existed even before 1916, which was quite rare, as many had disbanded at the onset of the First World War. Because of his previous jobs, George would have known how to handle a weapon, to drill men, etc., so he would have been the ideal candidate to lead a company. In 1920, O'Dwyer was elected the overall commander of the 3rd Kilkenny IRA Battalion, so that's the entire Castlecomer area in North Kilkenny that also includes parts of South Laois. This battalion was also known as the North Kilkenny Battalion, and you will find it sometimes abbreviated on dispatches to NKB. George was elected OC following the arrest of the previous OC, that was Patrick or Pádraig Fleming, who had been the OC since 1918. From about a year prior to Coolbawn, George was living on the run from house to house. Not an easy life by any means. Then in January 1921, he was elected overall leader of the entire County Kilkenny Brigade following the arrests of the two previous leaders. Firstly, Tom Tracy in November 1920 and then Peter Delucre in December 1920. Even before he was officially ratified in Kilkenny, he was summoned to Dublin to meet with Michael Collins on Christmas week 1920. They met over a pub on Parnell Street. George seemed to have got on very well with Collins. Michael Collins's pep talk seemed to inspire O'Dwyer, and he returned to Kilkenny with enthusiasm for the task ahead, especially needed in martial law here at Kilkenny. The basic synopsis of that meeting with Collins was, Kilkenny needs more shooting. There was too much concentration of Crown forces at this stage in Cork and Tipperary, for obvious reasons, and Collins wanted Kilkenny, and indeed Waterford as well, to up the ante, so Crown force resources would have to be transferred from those areas, in other words, spread the load and relieve some pressure. Collins also said that there should be a flying column in that part of Kilkenny not covered by the Callan flying column. Luckily for George O'Dwyer, the Greignamana IRA had already set up a small column of around 10 men working in their 5th Battalion area. O'Dwyer met the two leaders of this battalion and column, John Welch and Michael O'Carroll, and they agreed to work together. O'Dwyer dipped in and out of the column depending on when an attack was imminent and where he had to be for meetings. The presence of the column in East Kilkenny also allowed Dwyer to send men who were on the run in other parts of Kilkenny down to Greignamana to join the column and do a bit of training. This is how Sean Hartley joined the column in May 1921 after the column had returned from North Kilkenny after the Oscurity Wood ambush. Hartley, then working in Kilkenny City, was in constant fear of arrest as he had been left off by a judge in November 1920, having been arrested for having a revolver. He knew his card was marked and he would likely be arrested again, and so was happy to join the column. Nicholas Mullins joined the column around March or April 1921 and had taken part in the ambushes at Oscurity Wood and the no-show Kellymount ambush near Paulstown. He had entertained his column comrades with many a patriotic song, singing with his lovely tenor voice as they traipsed the countryside. Mullins's house in Thomastown was constantly being raided and he avoided staying there for fear of arrest. It should be noted that the distance between Greignamana and Castlecomer is over 40 kilometres, which is a fairly decent walk as these guys travelled on foot. Therefore, most of the column would have never have set foot literally in Coolbawn prior to the ambush and quite possibly never set foot there again afterwards. So by the time of the Coolbawn ambush, the column had nearly 20 men who were basically full-time soldiers. I'll give a quick rundown of who was in the column at the various stages just to show the geographical spread of the men. So in charge of the column nominally was George O'Dwyer, but he wouldn't have been around day to day, so the command fell to Michael O'Carroll and John Welch, both of whom were from the Greignamana area, although Welch moved to Dublin in later life and O'Carroll lived in Thomastown. Also from in and around Greignamana, you had the brothers Christopher and James Doyle, Patrick Quinn and Robert Doyle. Robert Doyle was actually from Ballymurphy, County Carlow. From the Roar was Martin Bates. From Innistee came Michael O'Hanrahan. From Tullerone was Ned Holland. From Three Castles, Kilkiernan side of things was John Wall. James Purcell was from Galstown. And from Kilkenny City, you had James Massey Delaney, Kieran Cody, John Keane, the latter two of Parliament Street. You had Michael Root, Michael McSweeney from Irishtown, and he is the grandfather, by the way, of the great Kilkenny historian Jim Marr. From Goran, you had Kieran Tobin. Then, of course, as I mentioned, there were Sean Hartley of Glenmore and Nicholas Mullins from Thomastown. So a great spread around the county there. Now, Jordan Dwyer slash Michael O'Carroll's Kilkenny number one flying column did not have a great deal of luck up to that point. In May, they had participated in the unsuccessful ambush at Oscarty Wood near Castlecomer. Some Crown forces were wounded during the altercation, but overall it was a close call, and lucky that none of the IRA were captured or killed. In April 1921, there was a Crown Force no-show ambush near Paulstown, and there was also an abortive attack on Bagnallstown RIC barracks, which is just over the border in County Carlow. This was a joint initiative with the Carlow IRA Brigade, but the Crown forces seemed to have got wind of the imminent attack and swarmed the area beforehand. So the attack had to be abandoned. The column really couldn't catch a break. As Michael O'Carroll put it in later life, for George, things never seemed to go right. As you would discover, Coolbawn was not any better. Remember, Kilkenny was a martial law area from January 1921, and that's for the final 6 months of the War of Independence. Things would have been difficult. For example, there was curfews in most of the towns, so you couldn't be out at night. It was harder to move around, and a permit was even required for you to own a bicycle, let alone have a motor car. The Crown forces also had the authority to stop and search anybody they wanted. If you had a gun on you, it was possible you could be sentenced to death. Even more pressure was heaped on poor George O'Dwyer when Earl O'Malley was made commander of the 2nd Southern IRA Division. This division encompassed parts of Limerick, Tipperary and all of County Kilkenny. Basically, it meant that O'Malley was O'Dwyer's new boss in the new tier of command. O'Dwyer would therefore be reporting to O'Malley directly instead of to IRA GHQ. O'Malley was a tough taskmaster, a workaholic in terms of fighting the War of Independence. O'Malley didn't have the best memories of Kilkenny either. He was captured in Inistigue just a few months before in December 1920, partly because of his own carelessness and cockiness, it must be said. He then suffered terrible beatings by the Crown forces before escaping brilliantly from prison 2 months later in February 1921. O'Malley was a highly energetic, brave and driven figure. He wouldn't take excuses. He wanted action, 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 especially since he was in charge of the two other counties, Limerick and Tipperary, where a lot of pressure was being exerted. I really wouldn't envy being George O'Dwyer in the final 6 months of the War of 1921. Pressure from all directions. And remember, these guys are doing this all for the cause. They were getting zero benefits, financial, material or otherwise, from doing this work in 1921. So you had to have a lot of passion. So to go back to the story at hand, in the days prior to the Coolbawn ambush, all the column men stayed in safe houses close enough to Coolbawn, mostly around the Lots, the Coon areas, and with some just over the Leash border in Gorton Isle, which is about 8 kilometres away. It was only the column men that knew at this stage of the plan to ambush the soldiers at Coolbawn. Many of the local regular IRA did not, although the IRA company which Coolbawn was part of did know. This was known as the Upper Hills Company and led by Martin Byrne. This company prepared the ambush site. Indeed, one of those who prepared the area, Thomas Mealy, was killed the following year during the Civil War. It had been arranged with a local priest, Father McNamara, who was friendly to the independence cause, that he would make himself available to hear the IRA men's confession on the night before the ambush. This was quite common on the eve of a major altercation. It was important to most people at this time to have received the sacrament of absolution in case, without putting too fine a point on us, they were to meet their maker the next day. At one stage that evening, there was 16 people queuing up outside Father McNamara's house at clock for confession. Father McNamara was the curate at Monaghan Rue and presided as a judge at some of the local Sinn Féin courts in the area during the previous year. Afterwards, the column men had tea at Father McNamara's house. During the previous months, if the column had been out on a Sunday and it was unsafe for them to get mass, a priest would be sought. Father James Delaney of Muckalee Parish was also very accommodating to them. That same evening, before the Coolbawn ambush, O'Dwyer sent dispatches to the 11 captains of the Castlecomer 3rd IRA Battalion. From each captain, he requested they send 4 of their men to the ambush site at Coolbawn at 5:30 a.m. the following morning. He did not say exactly why they were needed, which was standard in case the messages fell into the wrong hands. These men were going to act as scouts or lookouts, amongst other tasks. It was noted that only 2 of the captains received their dispatches in a timely manner, and these 2 dispatches were couriered by Cumann na mBan. No surprise there. On the day of the ambush, 8 of the 11 companies sent men, but around 3 groups did not, and this is where the first bit of controversy arose afterwards. The 3 companies had different reasons for not sending the men. E Company, also known as Loon Company, did not send men, as their captain said his men had already been out on IRA work earlier that week and thought one night in the week sufficient when they all had to work the next day. If anything, this highlights how people at this time had to make a living along with their revolutionary work. It's likely he would have sent men had he known the significance of the day, but it's likely he did not know his men were needed as ambush scouts, a very important role. A Company, also known as the Swan Company, did not send their 4 men either. The captain of that company was Michael Fleming, who in fairness did respond to O'Dwyer's dispatch, but told O'Dwyer, "Sorry, I don't believe in your action, wishing you luck," end quote. What made Fleming's refusal to take part more controversial was, not only was he leader of the Swan area, but he was also OC of the entire Castlecomer 3rd Battalion. Fleming's brother Porrig was leader of the Castlecomer area previously, but was replaced by O'Dwyer on his arrest. The Flemings had been involved in the volunteer movement for many, many years, even before O'Dwyer was around, so it's possible that they were not happy with his leadership, but we can only surmise at this stage. In addition, at a battalion meeting some days previously, Fleming and the other 3rd Battalion officers had objected to the ambush plan. They did not agree with the physical geographic location of the ambush and had suggested an alternative spot near the Anglican Church in Castlecomer. Also, and perhaps most importantly, there had been an agreement between the IRA and the local trade union secretary, Tom Campion, which had been in place since the year before. The agreement had vowed not to interfere in any way with the workings of the coal mines, as its closure would affect the livelihoods of many, many local inhabitants. The ambush would therefore break that agreement, with the consequences of such an action unknown. The hinterland in the vicinity of the Swan Company would also have borne the brunt of the colliery closure. However, O'Dwyer had got the all clear from IRA GHQ, that's Michael Collins, to attack the Gelignite delivery. O'Dwyer was not best pleased with the non-appearance of Fleming and immediately dismissed him from his position as Battalion OC. Another company captain, Garrison Gerard Brennan, was appointed 3rd Battalion OC effective immediately. Despite these local tensions, most of the IRA men needed arrived near the ambush position the next morning, Saturday the 18th of June 1921, on schedule before 5:30 a.m. In fact, the flying column itself had come much earlier, and George O'Dwyer was there since 1:30 a.m. The column had mustered at Johnny Summers' yard in Coon East for a final roll call. In total, there was nearly 20 column men, and over 30 regular IRA from around the Castlecomer district would take part in the ambush in some form or other. Some would not have been armed and acted as scouts. So that's over 50 people in and around the Coolbawn area ready for action on that June morning. Some of the ammunition and weapons had been brought to the site earlier by Cumann na Mban. The Paulstown IRA, part of the 4th Battalion, also chipped in with ammo delivered to Cumann by Helen Fottrell, a leading member of Cumann na Mban there. Saturday the 18th of June 1921 was a bright sunny morning in what would turn out to be a very hot June day. Ireland was experiencing something of a drought by this time in June 1921. There had not been a decent spell of rain in over a month, and there wouldn't be for another few weeks. Not a great time for the farmers. The meet-up point that morning was an old uninhabited house known as the Coach House, also known locally as the Woodhouse. It was just off a small country road which was to the east of the Coolbawn ambush position, but closer to the Leash or the northern end. The Coach House, Woodhouse, became something of a HQ for the IRA men, with George O'Dwyer organising people into different positions from there. The Coolbawn ambush also had an additional layer of complexity. A landmine was to be used in the attack, which was a rare enough event at this time, especially in County Kilkenny. It had been prepared by Frank Fogarty, who made the detonator. He was an engineer by trade. Ironically, the explosive used in the homemade landmine was gelignite, 30 pounds of it, which had been taken by the miners working in the coal mine who were also IRA members. They set up the landmine that morning by placing it in a skillet, which is kind of like a large saucepan, digging a hole in the middle of the road and placing the mine in there. The mine was then covered and clay and dust spread, so it wouldn't be noticed the ground had been disturbed. Remember, this is a pre-tarmac era, so the roads were basically just hard clay or earth. It was dusty this time of year, especially with the dry spell, but in winter it would be very mucky. Because of the presence of this landmine, the IRA had to stop anyone going down or up the road in case the mine went off. Most traffic that morning was coming from the Leash side towards Castle Comer, as it was Mart Day in Comer. The general public then had to be diverted into the old coach house and told to wait under armed supervision until the ambush was over. This had the additional benefit of not letting anyone into Castle Comer who may have harmlessly gossiped about what they saw on the way, thus endangering their plans. By 9 a.m. it was reported that over 50 civilians were already corralled into the coach house, with 27 horses also tied up. In a situation like this, you could really do with a policeman. Luckily for the IRA, one of their men was a former RIC man. It was Big Paddy Brennan's job to stop the passers-by on the main Coolbawn Road, also known as the Dublin or Tyrone Road, explain the situation to them and order them in the direction of the coach house and wait. It was Dick Summers from Clock whose job it was to arrange and hold them there. The complaints and arguments must have been a big headache for the men. Now to take a look at the ambush site itself. As mentioned, the chosen location was 4 kilometres north of Castle Comer. George O'Dwyer had walked the potential ambush site with Flying Column leaders Michael O'Carroll and John Welsh 2 months previously when they happened to be up in Castle Comer. On paper, the spot was a decent location. There was a fairly straight stretch of road with a slight bend at either end. This meant the Crown Forces would not be able to see far ahead until they cleared the bend and were nearly at the ambush position. Think of it much like where you'd see the Garda checkpoints today. They are usually after a bend in the road or a brow of a hill. You are nearly on top of them before you see them, and there's usually no opportunity of avoiding them or turning around into a different road. It is, of course, strategic. It's not by chance. Thus it was the case, and the same idea was our would-be ambushers back in 1921. Hopefully the accompanying maps will help you, but if you can't see them, I will try to describe it in simple terms. Think of the road running vertical south to north, with the Crown Forces expected to come from the south, i.e. from the Castle Comer direction. So then we have an east side of the ambush and a west side of the ambush site. All the IRA ambush party were in the fields on the east side of the road with nobody on the west side. This was because, for the most part, there was a high bank on the west side which towered over the road. This was because this new section of the Coolbawn Road was cut out the previous century. So if the ambush had gone ahead, the Crown Forces could not have escaped directly west, which is another reason this position was good. There was also a good deal of overgrowth in the location for cover. The ambushers in the fields on the east side were protected behind something like a double ditch. That is, there was first a bank of hard clay, then a low stone wall, then a ditch of briars and skiocks and trees. Staying on the east side also offered the IRA men a better chance to retreat into the more rural areas of the northeast away from Comer. The fields the ambush party were in sloped down behind them into a ravine or glen where the small river Bracca flowed. The three leaders of the column were in three key positions, manning three separate sections, as they call them. The first man in the ambush line on the Castle Comer side was John Welsh. In the middle of the ambush position was George O'Dwyer, the commander that day, and on the furthest end section on the north side of the site was Michael O'Carroll. The key important position was located in the middle of the ambush location. Here, Garrett Brennan from Castle Comer, the newly promoted leader of the 3rd Battalion, was waiting to detonate the landmine. He was an ex-British Army man, having worked as a communications officer in the First World War, so he would have been one of the few who had experience with wires and electronics, although primitive by today's standards. He kept a detonator in his hand at all times. O'Dwyer was located there too. If everything went to plan, the convoy would pass through the ambush position and go past the initial ambush section. When the first lorry was in the middle of the ambush location, that is directly over the landmine, Brennan was to detonate it. The attack would then commence. O'Carroll was to make sure the driver of the first lorry was disabled, that's if he hadn't already been in the mine blast. John Welsh, who was in the front part of the ambush, was to disable the driver of the second lorry in case he tried to reverse back towards Castle Comer to get away from the firing. But as you've probably guessed by now, the day did not turn out as planned. But given the circumstances, actually, things had started out relatively smoothly. The Crown Forces were expected sometime between 8:30 a.m. and 9:30 a.m. A lookout post was situated to the rear of the ambush location near Glenmullen Woods. Here, IRA men were positioned up a tree and could see right into Castle Comer using a telescope and field glasses. It was possible to even see the front wall of the army barracks from this position. The lookouts were able to tell O'Dwyer that lorries had pulled up near the military barracks, meaning that the Crown Forces should be on the move shortly. O'Dwyer and all the ambush party were in their positions at this stage. As stated, the first man in the ambush line was John Welsh. Next to him was Nicholas Mullins. Next to him was Sean Hartley. And next to him was James Doyle of Greignamana. Nicholas Mullins, who was dressed in a normal civilian suit, did not have a rifle that morning. A rifle was a prerequisite for an ambush, as a shotgun was not of much use for distance shooting. Luckily for him, or unluckily as it turned out, the nearby company captain James Comerford had a rifle and gave it to Mullins. Comerford, who became a New York judge in later life, wrote a very detailed book about his time in the Kilkenny IRA. You probably heard of it. Comerford was told by O'Dwyer he could not participate in the ambush as he had picked up a bad wound during an arms raid on a house some weeks previously, which still hadn't healed properly. Comerford remembers Mullins saluting him with his rifle as he left the area, apparently saying thanks for the gun. So he was delighted with Comfort's Lee Enfield rifle. That rifle had been obtained by Jim Jackie Brennan, who took it slash bought it from a British soldier one night in Ballyragget in 1920. The rifle had been used for practice firing and training purposes with the Coon IRA since, but by 1921, of course, it was being used in action. By the way, as the rifle had a serial number, it was able to be traced back by the Crown Forces after they captured it after the ambush. It confused them no end how a rifle taken in Ballyragget a year previously ended up in the hands of a Thomastown man. Sean Harty looked the part that morning in Coolbawn, as he was in his custom-made Irish Volunteers uniform. He had prepared the perfect peephole for himself through the briars and stone wall at his position as he waited for the Crown Forces to arrive. As Comfort left the area, Sean Harty said to him, "I hope you'll be all right soon. Better luck next time," in reference to Comfort having to miss out on the ambush due to his injury. Another little story I find interesting occurred as the men were waiting in their ambush positions. As they would be crouched down and undoubtedly bored sitting in a ditch for so long, Jack Hawney was sent down with a big sack of fresh laundry to deliver to the men. This included socks and undergarments for the IRA men, which had been sent up from the Gregnamana coming them on. Now, I certainly can only imagine all the blisters on the feet these men would have had in early 1921, walking miles and miles through fields. Their feet were also nearly constantly damp for the same reasons. The sight and feel of a dry pair of freshly darned socks must have been like winning the lotto for them, we can only imagine. Now, a chain of events set all the best laid plans for the Coolbawn ambush into disarray. Before 8 a.m. that morning, a farm labourer named Sandy Bradley was corralled into the coach house. He complained profusely to the IRA men detaining him, telling them that he was already late for work in the nearby townland of Finsborough. He had 14 cows to milk and would get in trouble with his employer, Florence or Florrie Draper, if he didn't turn up soon. His employment was only a kilometre away. He did not need to go near the ambush site, he just needed to get across the main Coolbawn road to get to Finsborough townland, which was on the other side. After about 40 minutes of arguments, the IRA men relented and let him go through. He arrived at his employer and gave his excuse as to why he was late after she quizzed him on it. His employer, Florrie Draper, was a loyalist and did not support the Sinn Féin movement sweeping the country. She owned a substantial farm of over 200 acres and I guess was more than happy with the way things were. Better the devil you know and all that. She evidently now believed that it was her civic duty to let the Crown Forces know what was waiting for them at Coolbawn. She left her home around 9 a.m. She took an alternate route on horseback, not going to Coolbawn itself, but by going through Loon, across the River Dineen and going into the town by the train tracks. This is another part of the Coolbawn controversy, as the scouts earmarked for the Loon area were one of the groups that did not turn up that morning. Florrie Draper's appearance coming into town by the train tracks was noted as unusual by some people who saw her. She walked up to the barracks and was left in. She informed the military of what she knew. She had gleaned a good bit of information from her workman and was able to point the rough positions of where she believed the ambush party were on a detailed ordnance survey map the military had. The Crown Forces now quickly drew up a plan to ensnare the ambush. The hunters had become the hunted. The Crown Forces stationed in the barracks were made up of three wings of British law enforcement. These were the soldiers or military, made up of the Devonshire Regiment. There was also Black and Tans, and then there was the regular RIC. From the archives, and that's the British archives, we can see that there was a major disagreement between the separate wings of the Crown Forces in how many men they could send out and how many should stay behind in the barracks. The RIC men in charge of the actual barracks complex, Sergeant John Clancy, was terrified an IRA column could storm the barracks and capture us. That is, that Coolbawn was a diversion. Now, that would not have been great for his career prospects. There was over 50 men stationed in the barracks that day. The leader of the military side was Lieutenant Bovill, sarcastically known locally as Captain Bovril. Eventually, it was decided to send a party of about 30 men out to Coolbawn and telephone the main barracks in Kilkenny City to send reinforcements to protect the barracks. By the way, the phone lines in the area were not cut by the IRA in order not to arouse suspicion. Cut phone lines could give the Crown Forces a clue that trouble was in the offing. Just after 10:45 a.m, the party of Crown Forces made their way from the barracks and took an unusual route to get to Coolbawn. The party was made up of at least 14 soldiers of the Devonshire Regiment and around 10 RIC, which included Black and Tans. Cleverly enough, before they even got near Coolbawn crossroads, the Crown Forces left the roadway and made their way to the area through the fields, skirting the ditches. Scouts in the area would have had their eyes peeled on the road, not the fields. The Crown Forces then split into two groups. The 10 or so policemen, i.e. the Black and Tans and the RIC, crossed the Coolbawn Road and made their way towards the ambush site from the west side, on the high ground side of things. The second party, made up of the military soldiers, went along the small gorge or glen of the Brocka River, which was all but dried up at this stage of the summer. So in other words, these soldiers were moving directly behind the backs of the IRA men who were on the other side of the glen and facing the other direction. Around this time, the IRA men were having their packed lunch, along with slices of bread that had been sent down from John Comfort's grocery and bakery just up the road. They were likely thinking the ambush was now off, as there was no sign of the military lorries leaving Comer, as they thought. However, just before 11:30 a.m, a scout on the western side of the Coolbawn Road saw two RIC men coming down Wright's or Condell's Lane in the middle of the ambush site on the bend. Both sets of men got a fright as the RIC jumped and hid in the ditch. These men were obviously doing the initial scouting for the Crown Forces. When the fighting eventually broke out, these RIC men cleverly wheeled a cart in front of them down the lane for protection while they were shooting at IRA positions from behind us. So then what happened was one of the IRA scouts, Tom Duffy, ran down to tell O'Dwyer what he had seen. It must have been quite shocking for O'Dwyer to realise that Crown Force personnel had managed to get so close without anyone noticing. He did not know, of course, how many were there or where they were in the area. He sent Big Paddy Brennan on the not-so-nice mission to run down the middle of the Coolbawn Road to whisper loudly to the men along the ditches that the Crown Forces were in the vicinity and to be alert. John Welch and his section of men at the front of the ambush position did not hear the message, however. A moment later, a scout from the Glenmullen Wood side of things, behind O'Dwyer's position, arrived to tell him that soldiers had been spotted moving up the glen, directly behind their backs. O'Dwyer then knew that they were being ensnared in a cordon. He needed to get everyone out of there as quickly as possible, or else they'd be surrounded. The time was now just 11:30 a.m. Then all hell seemed to break loose. John Welch described it from his perspective as follows, quote, "Mullins, Hartley and myself were partaking of some food, bread and a bottle of milk which we were passing around to one another, when suddenly a volley of fire rang out from a party of British troops who had silently occupied the dried up bed of a stream around 250 yards to our rear. John Hartley was killed by this first volley. Quinn Doyle, O'Hanrahan, Mullins and myself took cover immediately and for some time returned the fire of the British troops. It soon became apparent to us that we were being fired on from both of our flanks as well as from the stream bed. There appeared to be no hope of contacting the main body of the column, and our only chance of getting away was to get on the road, cross it, and seek cover in the high meadow field, which we could see across the road. Still under fire, we managed to reach the road safely. Quinn Hanahan and myself succeeded in crossing it and got into the meadow field. We crawled through the meadow field and eventually got away. That evening, we called to a farmer's house, Brennan's of Ballyuskell. It was in Brennan's house on the night of the ambush that I learned of their fate." End quote. What happened at the middle of the ambush position, where O'Dwyer's section were stationed, was that O'Dwyer gave three loud blasts of his whistle, which was a signal to retreat at once. As John Wells said in his account, Hartley was hit instantly in the first volley of shots. The bullet had entered his neck, severing his spine. He would have died very quickly. Then Mullins, along with James Doyle, who had been beside him, followed what Welch and Hanrahan had done. They went in the opposite direction away from the gunfire, i.e. they turned around and hopped through the ditch and over the wall to get onto the main Coolbawn Road for some protection. However, they would have been unaware that the group of Black and Tans and RIC had moved into the fields on the west side of the road in tandem with the military on the east side of the road. The RIC were in a great position on the high ground overlooking the Coolbawn Road. Doyle and Mullins were now sitting ducks, being the last two moving targets on the straight stretch of road. R.J. Gwinnell, a black and tan constable, shot at Mullins. The first shot hit Mullins in the hand, blowing off his little finger. He dropped his rifle, the rifle Comfort had given to him earlier. Mullins and Doyle then ran along a dike for cover. This dike was roughly where the memorial is today. However, Gwinnell, who was giving chase, shot at Mullins again. He was hit in the back with the bullet passing through his abdomen and out the other side. Doyle went to his aid, but he too was shot by Gwinnell in the leg. The rest of the column miraculously managed to escape, however, by moving along the ditches and escaping northeastwards. The Crown forces on the west side tried to spray the ditch with machine gun fire, but their location seemed to be just too high and the bullets knocked leaves and branches down over the heads of the IRA men. Scouts did a great job in helping anyone not familiar with the terrain to escape. Some of the column laid low until nightfall in Glenmullen Wood near the ambush site. The military did not appear inclined to risk their own lives by venturing into the woods. Afterwards, they searched everyone in the coach house and brought some of the detainees with them, kind of like shields, as they believed the IRA wouldn't fire on them if they had civilians with them. In their official report afterwards, the Crown Forces defended why they hadn't given chase to the column, stating that their numbers were just too low to safely pursue them. The Crown Forces suffered no casualties during the Coolball altercation, and all in all, it was a good day for them. The Grignamana column contingent left the area the following night. Father McNamara had brought those staying in Ballyoskill, including the column leader Welsh, to the lots in his pony and trap on the Sunday before they went towards home that night. Hartley's body and the two injured men were brought by commandeered horse and trap to Castlecomer Barracks. The military had stopped Edward Dooley, a local farmer, on his horse and cart, who just happened to be passing through Coolbawn with the intention of getting coal. He was ordered to bring back the three IRA men to the barracks. Upon arriving back in the town, Beauville ordered his men to line up in a military formation ahead of the cart. They then marched dramatically up the main streets with the bloodied body of Hartley and the badly injured Mullins and Doyle visible for all to see. An IRA report sent to GHQ after the events at Coolbawn said that Hartley was, quote, finished off by the black and tan constable Blunt. This is possible as his severed spine injury is consistent with a bullet to the back of the head or neck, but Blunt was also a World War I crack shot, so he could have struck him from a distance, and Welsh, who was beside Hartley when he was shot, believed he died instantly. James Doyle, who survived, was stabbed with a bayonet in both legs to make sure he wouldn't try to escape. Nicholas Mullins died from his injuries 2 hours after being hit at around 2:30 p.m. the bullets having passed through his liver. In Sean Hartley's pocket, a pamphlet was found. Hundreds of these anti-IRA leaflets were dropped like confetti over Kilkenny City by the Crown Forces by an airplane some weeks earlier, would you believe? Hartley had obviously kept it as an amusing souvenir. The Devonshire officer who wrote the report of the Coolbawn ambush remarked cynically that Sean, quote, appears to have disregarded the information in this leaflet in what would have proved in his case some sound advice, end quote. James Doyle, having been shot twice, survived his injuries. He had an unpleasant experience of waking up from his unconscious state the following day to find he was lying between the lifeless bodies of his two comrades, the military presuming he would have passed away during the night also. He described what occurred, quote, I became semi-conscious and saw I was lying between my two comrades and that both were dead. I was unable to move. Later in the day, I saw Crown Forces come into the place where they were to remove the bodies, and they were surprised to see that I was alive. End quote. In the aftermath of events at Coolbawn, a 3rd Battalion meeting was held in a field near Cross, which was chaired by OC Jair or Garrett Brennan. Also in attendance was Kilkenny Brigade OC Geordie O'Dwyer. The information about Flory Draper giving the info to the Crown Forces had come to light by then, and it was decided she should be punished in some way for contributing to the deaths of the two column men and the capture of another. Emotions were high, and some in attendance said Draper should be executed as an informer as a consequence of her actions. However, it was pointed out by Brennan that the IRA GHQ had prohibited the execution of women, while in addition, they should avoid the negative publicity that had been caused by the Cork IRA when they executed a female informer named Mary Lindsay just 3 months previously. After a vote, it was decided to burn Draper's house down and demand she left the country. Martin Byrne, captain of the Upper Hills IRA company, where the townland of Finsbury was located, was to take charge of the burning. At about 11 p.m. at night, around 30 members of the 3rd Battalion IRA converged on the home of Flory Draper. She lived in Finsborough House near Coolbawn, as I said, with her sister Rebecca. The IRA told Flory that she had been found guilty of informing and that her house would be burnt as a result. The sisters were given a few minutes to gather their belongings and money and to vacate the house. Rebecca quickly moved to the outside stable with some of the IRA men helping to carry her clothes. However, Florrie went onto the flat roof of the house with her dog and jumped into a steel water tank. One of those present, Michael Welsh of Sidegate Castlecomer, said Draper also threw bombs or grenades at them, given to her by the military for her own protection, from which she received a bad injury that troubled him for the rest of his life. The house, however, was quickly set alight. Florrie fired flares into the night sky from a very gun the military had given to her with the hope of attracting their attention. If the Crown Forces in Castlecomer had not seen the flares, they could not have missed the inferno that was Finsbury House lighting up the horizon. When the military arrived nearly 2 hours later, the house was gutted by the fire, but Florrie Draper and her dog had survived in a steel water reservoir up on the flat roof. The Draper sisters soon moved to Surrey in England after intimidation increased during the weeks after the ambush. Cattle were ran into their fields to trample on the crops, while two of their horses were stabbed in the legs to make them useless for working the fields. It appears, though, that the Draper sisters had already planned to sell up and move away even before the Coolbawn ambush. An auction of Finsbury House and lands was advertised in February and April 1921, some months before the ambush, but the property failed to sell. The auctioneer's ad described the holding as 217 statute acres, with land that is sound, healthy and well watered, all in grass except for about 1 acre. The residence was described as modern and in beautiful order, while stating that the outhouses, including a 100-ton hay barn, are extensive and in excellent condition. The land, though, was only purchased outright by the Drapers with the Lands Acts of 1903, although the Draper family themselves were there a lot longer, so the new owners would be required to pay £62 per year to the Land Commission. However, just a week after the truce came into being in July 1921, and less than 5 weeks after the ambush, an auction took place outdoors in the farmyard at Finsbury, in the shadow of the charred remains of the house. Here, the livestock, machinery and farm tools were auctioned off. The animals included 16 horses, including one splendid brown draft mare and foal, and also included 11 milking cows and 50 hens. 15 cocks of hay were also auctioned off, and everything from buckets, churns, manure, firewood and a mowing machine were put up for sale. It showed that the Drapers were getting out of there, perhaps even quicker than they anticipated. The sisters later requested £5,000 in compensation for the destruction of their property and belongings from Kilkenny County Council, but were later awarded just £452 by the Free State Government. So in today's terms, they requested circa €300,000, but were awarded approximately €26,000. But they did also receive money from the Lyless funds provided by the British government, so it's possible they received closer to their original request. In a twist of fate, Rebecca Draper died 3 years to the day after the Coolbawn ambush. That's the 18th of June 1924, aged 57. Florrie Draper died in 1930 at the age of 60. The large farm was firstly used as something like a commonage between the local farmers, but was later divided and redistributed by the Land Commission. Generously, there was even talk of offering the land to the families of the two deceased Flying Column men, but the families were the first to turn down this offer, although they were thankful of the toss. Sandy Bradley was also going to be held to account by the IRA and likely ordered to leave the area, but luckily for him, he was reprieved with the onset of the truce. Now we will take a look at the funerals of the two column men. Sean Hartley's funeral took place first in Glenmore on Tuesday the 21st of June 1921, and just 3 days after the ill-fated Coolbawn ambush. Hartley, who was 23 years old at the time of his death, was originally from Wetherstown in Glenmore in the south of the county. His body was moved by train to Waterford railway station the evening previously. His father, Edmund, had to go to Kilkenny Barracks to claim his body. Hundreds of people were present at Waterford station when the train arrived, and people started saying the rosary as his coffin was moved into the hearse. The military were antagonistic at his funeral the next day. One local woman, Ellen Casson, who was present, described the events as follows, quote, "I was searched at the chapel gate. One man ordered me to put up my hands and to open my shawl. The black and tans were in the porch as I entered. They stood around the coffin in the chapel. They did not take off their caps. They were using violent language. Their conduct during the service was not becoming. There was a glass panel at the side of the coffin. As the people tried to look in at the corpse, the black and tans made a remark such as, 'Who do you want to see?' and pushed the slide back." End quote. A volley of shots was fired over the grave of Sean as soon as the military had left later that afternoon. Sean Hartley had one brother and one sister. From his teenage years, he became heavily active in the Irish Volunteers, even before the 1916 rebellion. This was quite unusual as there wasn't that many Irish Volunteer companies around in rural Ireland prior to 1916. The company of Volunteers he was a member of were from nearby New Ross in County Wexford. Because of his membership in the New Ross Volunteers, he was arrested after the 1916 rebellion and sent to Wakefield prison. He was released a month later. In the years prior, Sean had been employed in Thomas Grace's pub and provision store in Kilkenny City. He lived above the shop with the other employees. Grace's premises is still there and is now known as the Pump House Pub on Parliament Street, and that's opposite the Watergate Theatre. In Kilkenny, he became an active member of the Kilkenny Grocery Assistance Association, kind of like a union. He played Gaelic football initially with Glenmore and later with the CYMS club in Kilkenny City. He excelled as a tough fuller centre back. 8 months before Coolbawn, he was arrested on the night of the 7th of October 1920, along with Leo Dardis, following a military raid. The Crown Forces obviously had a tip-off. A revolver and 10 rounds were found underneath a cardboard box in his shared bedroom. He was brought to Cork Barracks but was released after a month as the military judge there found him not guilty due to the insufficient evidence. That is, because other people were sharing the room, it could not be proved that the gun and the bullets were his. Sean's father later received £50, that's around €4,000 in today's money, for his son's death from the Free State government, although he initially asked for £3,000. The recriminations about events started soon afterwards. Father Edward Hartley of New Ross, who was a cousin of the deceased and participated in his funeral mass, wrote to IRA GHQ and Michael Collins in October 1921. In his letter, he castigated Georgia Dwyer, saying that the scousing must have been rotten to let such a calamity happen. He also queried how Georgia Dwyer was able to buy a farm the previous month, insinuating he used IRA funds. He also referred to George O'Dwyer's deceased father as a land grabber. It is easy to see then how people could fall out over such things, but we can only imagine the shock it must have been for both families. The last day I heard, their sons were in Greignamana or Kilkenny. Then they get the news that they were killed in action in Castlecomer at the other end of the county. Turning now to Nicholas Mullins, his funeral took place in Thomastown the day after Hartley's, that's Wednesday, 22nd of June 1921. Mullins was 28 years old at the time of his death. The family seemingly first had confirmation of his death through a postman who delivered post to Kilkenny Military Barracks, but who knew the family in Thomastown. He cycled down to Thomastown on the day after Nicholas's death to let them know the sad rumours were actually true. Nicholas's body arrived into Thomastown Railway Station the evening prior to his funeral, his brother Thomas having to go up to Kilkenny Military Barracks to claim his remains. Anyone already in the church before the funeral arrived were made leave by the Crown Forces. A huge crowd of thousands of people descended on Thomastown for the funeral the next day. The auxiliaries from Woodstock and the RIC were out in force at his funeral and rounded up 30 young men at gunpoint in order to get them to clear the roads of trees that had been cut down around the outskirts of the town to impede the lorries, of course. Some who refused were arrested and brought to Woodstock later that day. The tricolour flag was also taken off Nicholas's coffin by the military. He was laid to rest in the old graveyard. Nicholas Mullins was the fourth child and eldest son in a family of 11. The family ran a shop and pub in Market Street, Thomastown. Nicholas's father, Lawrence, who was originally from Glenmore and distantly related to the Hartley family, had already passed away in 1914 from a kidney disease when Nicholas was just 20 years old, leaving Nicholas's mother, Annie, a widow at 50 with 11 children, aged between 7 and 26. In his youth, Nicholas joined the local amateur drama club in Thomastown. Indeed, he had a very good singing voice. The night before his death, his column friends remember him singing The Green Hills of Old Holy Ireland, where they could all join in the chorus. Mullins was a very good hurler as well with the local Chapel Hill Hurling Club. He even played junior hurling with the Kilkenny County team for 3 years. Nicholas worked as a carter for the Kilkenny Corporation based out of Thomastown before he joined the Flying Column. Annie Mullins, that's Nicholas's mother, received £100 for the loss of her son from the Free State government. In 1953, 30 years later, and at the age of 89, she also received a military pension in Nicholas's memory of £180 per year, but died 2 years later in 1955, aged 91. Up until he died in 1982, Nicholas's brother Tom Mullins, who was 2 years younger, used to pay his respects at the Coolbawn Monument on the anniversary in June every year. After Nicholas's death in June 1921, the councillors in the local Thomastown Union passed a motion at their monthly meeting tendering their heartfelt sympathy to, quote, the relatives of the late Mr. Nicholas Mullins, who willingly gave up his young life on the altar of his country. He died so that Ireland might live, and in his death showed an example of heroic sacrifice and chivalry worthy of the man and the cause for which he died, end quote. Aptly, in 2015, county councillors voted to rename the bridge in Thomastown the Nicholas Mullins Bridge. His family home overlooked the bridge, and a new sign was put on it by the Kilkenny County Council in June 2021 to mark the centenary of his death. So what's happened to some of our other protagonists mentioned in this story? James Doyle, the column man who fell beside Nicholas Mullins that day, was only 21 years old in 1921. He spent the night after he was shot on a cold slab floor in the military barracks in between his two deceased comrades. In later life, Doyle blamed that experience for a recurring lung condition, and he later got bronchitis and emphysema. It took Doyle many months to recover from the physical injuries received at Coolbawn that day. He spent over 3 months between the Kilkenny, Care and Tipperary military hospitals and was later transferred to Waterford Prison and imprisoned with hard labour. However, this was more preferable than his original sentence of execution, which had been commuted. He was one of the last to be released from prison in January 1922 following the signing of the treaty that was 7 months after the Coolbawn ambush. Later in 1922, he was operated on in St. Vincent's Hospital in Dublin after the Free States Army had taken military control. He became a local intelligence officer for the Free States Army during the Civil War. Afterwards, he worked as a labourer and lived out his life on the Tinahinch side of Greignamana. He was also lame for the rest of his life, as the shrapnel from the bullet wound he received in Coolbawn was left in his foot for the remainder of his life, which caused recurring problems. It was deemed at the time it would do more harm than good if they attempted to remove it by surgery. He also had bayonet stab wounds to both thighs, which he said sometimes flared up. He received £25 from the Irish White Cross when recuperating. He received a £75 injury payment and £40 per annum between 1922 and 24 from the Free State government. He received nothing then between 1924 and 1953, but was awarded a special allowance by the Irish government from 1953 of £71 per annum, as he could no longer work as a labourer due to all his ailments. This wasn't a major amount, you're talking 4,000 to 5,000 euros a year. He died just after the Easter 1966 commemorations in April 1966. He was actually aged just 66 years old. The leader at the Coolbawn ambush that day, George O'Dwyer, became an officer in the Free State Army in 1922. He was actually the highest ranking Kilkenny man present when what we now know as James Stephens Army Barracks was handed over to the IRA, later to become the Free State Army, in February 1922. That was an emotional day in the town, as the Union Jack was lowered and the tricolour flown with the Crown Forces literally marching out to get the train back to Dublin. George married Mary Angela Ní Mulrooney in the spring of 1922, herself a Cumannamon woman, but they had to cut their honeymoon short and return to Kilkenny after the anti-treaty forces took over the city in May 1922. He then joined the Guards, rising to the rank of Chief Superintendent. He retired in 1941, having served in 3 police forces around the world. He passed away in 1948 at 44 Harcourt Street in Dublin, aged just 62 years. He had been suffering from heart failure before that. Just to touch again on the controversies surrounding Coolbawn, I for one wouldn't be too hard on anyone who took part that day. I'm always conscious that it's very easy to be ultra-critical after the event, especially sitting on an armchair 100 years scrutinising in minute detail what someone should or shouldn't have done. Indeed, it's understandable that after the event people involved felt they needed to defend what they did that day. If no one had died, there wouldn't have been a word about it. There were so many moving variables that day, to try to single out any one person for the ambush's failure is not very useful. Historians are meant to totally avoid the what-ifs of history, the shoulda, coulda, woulda type of analysis, but I think George O'Dwyer was a decent and honest man, and I would say he would take his share of the responsibility, as really he was the boss that day and the buck had to stop with him. As the commander on the day, he had the ultimate responsibility for any successes or failures that occurred. He could have perhaps sent the dispatches requesting the scouts earlier, which would have allowed him time to organise a backup plan, although keeping things secret was probably a factor in this. There appeared to be a relaxed response in some quarters to what appeared to be yet another dispatch amongst many. The importance of this particular mission should have been emphasised. is all to argue that Draper would not have gone into town if these missing scouts were in their positions. But who's to say that the IRA scouts would have stopped a middle-aged woman going into town? She wasn't near the ambush site. Granted, she went an unusual route. But there could have been a contingency plan organised for the scouting. It was only a maximum of 12 people that didn't turn up. Some pointed a finger at those who left Sandy Bradley through the cordon, but again, that was an easy thing to do. Sandy was only working a few fields away and was not going near the ambush site, or Castlecomer for that matter. Bradley wasn't worried about an Irish Republic that day, which is fair enough. He was just thinking about his livelihood and the cows he had to milk. It is also possible that even if Draper did not go into Castlecomer, that suspicions could have been raised and the ministry not arrive. It was market day and there was at least 50 people with their animals missing from the town, with little traffic coming from the Dublin Road direction. This was bound to raise suspicions. So perhaps picking a busy market day was not the most opportune time. Similarly, the military usually went to the mines at least 2 days a week. Perhaps a less busy day could have been chosen. It was also an option not to use a mine at all, to have a smaller scale assault. Then it would have been possible to just wait for the military at Coolbawn and not involve any of the civilians who had to be diverted into a holding area. In other words, just let the traffic pass by as usual and only engage the military when the lorries arrived. But even if all this failed, there really should have been enough scouts on the Castlecomer side of things to alert the ambush party earlier. That was probably the biggest disaster of the whole day. The Crown forces were nearly on top of them before they knew of their presence. Perhaps some scouts were not where they were supposed to have been, or perhaps they were not posted to the most opportune areas. In fairness to O'Dwyer, he was in a bit of a catch-22 situation, in that the more scouts you had on the Castlecomer side, the more chance the military would spot one of them and guess what was going to happen ahead. Even with the scouts present, all eyes and ears were peeled for lorries, not soldiers on foot. When you consider how much organising O'Dwyer and his men had already done, for instance, they had sorted out the holding areas, the positions the column men were to take were all pre-decided, the medical or first aid assistance was on hand if needed, the retreat route was planned. O'Dwyer had even organised the people to take away any of the guns that were captured during the ambush. It is therefore surprising that the scouts issue, for whatever reasons, let him down. It was such an essential element of the whole thing. In that sense, perhaps the plan was too convoluted, where the simple and often most important elements were overshadowed. An old military saying goes that no plan survives the first contact with the enemy, which could be applied to Coolbawn. In fairness, one scout, Captain Jim Brennan of the Newtown Company, who was near Coolbawn Crossroads, did see the Crown forces and tried to fire a warning shot to alert the men, but his gun jammed. We must also not understate the actions of the Crown forces that day. They had a very good day at the office, whether people agree with them or not. Getting off the road and walking through the fields was a clever move, not something they usually did, although of course they did have that prior detail info by Draper. It could therefore be argued that two deaths was actually lucky in one way. It could have been a massacre if the machine guns were set up correctly and the Crown forces weren't spotted when they were, albeit it was still relatively late in the day. They had wanted to be parallel, directly behind the column men when they opened fire, but they were only barely opposite the first section of ambushers. And just to surmise, if you'll allow me, even if the two lorries had gone through the ambush site that day in Coolbawn and everything went to plan, then what? We know one thing that would not have happened. The mine would not have exploded. Thanks to Garrett Brennan's testimony, he said he tried to detonate the mine on a number of occasions when he was retreating and it failed to explode. Later that afternoon, the Crown forces even tried to detonate it, but they couldn't either and left it in case it exploded on top of them. The IRA came back that night and removed the mine safely. What might have happened in that scenario if the Crown forces drove along as planned and the mine didn't go off? The first lorry gets through, the IRA realise what happens and start shooting, but both lorries speed through the ambush site and escape. No one is injured and Coolbawn just becomes another footnote in Kilkenny's revolutionary history. By the way, as an aside, I've often thought if the landmine had gone off directly underneath the lorry carrying the gelignite, would it not have exploded the gelignite in that lorry and blown half the ambush party to Kingdom Come? I really don't know the answer to that question. The unexploded landmine was picked up by Michael Frank Fogarty during the night with the use of a hearse, so it could be hidden. The landmine was exploded during the truce. It could be heard from miles around, seemingly. I say all this just to highlight the array of things that might or might not have happened. Two people were killed, but it could easily have been 12 killed or just as easily no one killed. We must remember the IRA were not a professional outfit. They had fairly basic training and little armaments. What these men lacked for in munitions, they made up for in courage and an unwavering support for the cause and their fellow comrades. They weren't getting paid. The easiest thing to do in 1921 was probably to do nothing and keep your head down. These men and women were not afraid to stick their heads above the parapet. We should remember that. In other words, there was a hell of a lot of people in 1921 who played no part whatsoever in the revolutionary movement. So I wouldn't be overly critical of any of the men and women who were not afraid to play their part. I think that's where we'll leave it today. Just to thank you all for listening once again. I hope you enjoyed today's podcast. And don't forget to join your local library to avail of all the amazing free resources. Until next time.